2017. That's the Joint Effort for Hydro Modification Control and Low Impact Development.
Mr. Chairman, this is actually a project, board members, this is a project that the board has provided assistance, and actually it's the water board in total, because the regional board wanted to provide assistance to all the municipalities. We heard yesterday about the carrot and the stick approach. This was the carrot part, to provide assistance on coming up with criteria for hydro modification control. It's something that is not readily available to, in terms of the expertise of municipalities, and so this was to provide expertise. And the reason I say water boards in total is because the State Water Resources Control Board was kind enough to grant our request for funds from the cleanup and abatement account to help greatly with funding this effort. And Dominic Rock of our staff will be giving our presentation this morning. And by the way, this is a status report, but it's an item that will be coming back to you for action, I believe, at the July board meeting.
Good morning, Chairman Young, members of the board. Thank you very much. My name is Dominic Rock, and I'll present this update on the joint effort for hydro modification control and low impact development in the Central Coast. And I'll try to make sure I hit the right button here. Is anyone now? Button. Yeah. There we go. The last time I updated you was in December of 2010, so we're looking at just over a year, a little over a year since you've last heard about this, and of course there are new board members who I want to ensure have a good understanding of this project as well. Just to kind of start with what the joint effort is and sort of a concise statement, it's an effort to protect watershed processes from the impacts that occur when you develop the land and place it under new uses. And these are distinct from construction-related stormwater requirements. These are post-construction stormwater requirements. We've been working on this for quite some time, so I'll give you a little bit of history on the project, which is really the purpose of today, is to provide you with additional information, because in July we'll be coming back with a recommendation on these post-construction stormwater requirements. But in general, I want to cover some of the key concepts that underpin our development of hydro modification control criteria and describe the schedule that we're looking at over the next few months and prepare you, in essence, for making a decision in July. I'll start our look back in time. In 2005, when our board engaged in a prioritization exercise and identified urbanization as one of the primary causes of water quality impairment in the region. It was a fairly straightforward conclusion because of recognition that there's considerable growth anticipated in the Central Coast in the coming decades, even if we are currently in a slow phase of growth. And also evident when you look around at urbanization that there are major watershed impacts and water quality impacts associated with it. And an important regulatory tool that we use in controlling the impacts of stormwater on the landscape and on watersheds is the municipal stormwater permits. And the last meeting, not yesterday's, but the previous board meeting, you heard a fairly long discussion about the Salinas permit. And that's our only phase one permit in the region. Phase one just referring to larger communities that were the initial entities that would be subject to this requirement. But everyone else in our region is a phase two community. And this general permit is what we're using to enroll them under stormwater management. It was adopted in 2003 by the State Water Board, but it requires that the regional boards enroll each city and county into the permit through the approval of a stormwater management plan. Our early efforts in doing this were very contentious, and we found that by 2007, we had only enrolled 7 of our communities under the stormwater plan, and there's 40 communities that we have to work with here. So in 2007, I presented to you in a meeting in Santa Barbara an alternative to enrolling these entities under the permit, and you approved that and embraced that idea. Just to kind of give you this reminder of who we're talking about here, there are 40 communities in this region that are subject to the stormwater permits, and you'll find over this slide and the next slide that there's really all of the urban nodes, urbanization, or urban areas of our region are covered by this permit. So it's a lot of entities that are affected by everything we put into stormwater permits. Yes.
Matt, quick question. Can you go back to that list?
I think so. There's 2 of them, so.
Right. And so I see the UC campuses on there.
Yes.
But as I recall, aren't there other kind of little special districts like school districts?
There are.
Are they on the second page?
No. What we've done is we've included all of the entities that are enrolled and are currently enrolled under the permit. There's another tier of entities called non-traditional stormwater entities. They do include universities, prisons, federal facilities, school districts, et cetera. Our region has not, nor has any other region in the state, really aggressively pursued enrollment of those non-traditional entities under the general stormwater permit. But with the exception of 3 in our region, Vandenberg, UC Santa Cruz, UC Santa Barbara, and actually a couple of school districts as well, we've enrolled them as well under the permit.
Okay.
So and these are really just the cities and communities.
Okay. And what is the... Is that just a policy statewide that third group, non-traditional, is just a future phase of work, or is there some other reason why?
It's a result of prioritization at the regional board level.
Okay.
The State Water Board's general permit provided the regional boards with the option to enroll at such time as necessary these non-traditional entities.
Okay.
And so a lot of the regional boards were confronting the challenge of first enrolling the traditionals, mm-hmm. then getting to the non-traditionals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's been a outcome of the prioritization of our work, that we've not gotten to many of the non-traditionals.
And then the few non-traditionals that have been incorporated, was there a particular reason why those moved ahead, or just because geographically it made sense, or how did that work?
Well, I can't give you a reason for all of them. There mm-hmm. were a couple of school districts that kind of came out of the gate ready to go, and mm-hmm. they presented a stormwater management plan to our region, and we approved it. The universities, we actually prioritized them along with our traditionals because they're big land uses.
And they typically they have ongoing construction.
Ongoing construction.
I am so impressed at how often they renovate,
right.
if you will. Yeah.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Especially
okay.
with the, yeah. So.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Okay.
That helps to fill
sure.
in the picture.
Sure.
Mr. Delgado.
Yeah. Before you move on, Dominic.
Yes. I can move back. I just
one slide back.
Yeah. Sorry.
In the Monterey area, you list 6 cities, and not included there are 5 cities. Salinas, I know, is a different situation, but there are 5 smaller cities that are not listed, and I'm just curious why.
Because they are captured by the Monterey County's stormwater management. The entity of Monterey County addresses the unincorporated communities of Monterey. If I have a mistake here, let me know. But I think
well, I know that the city of Marina is included in that group as well.
Right.
So they would be excluded from this list by what you just said.
I think the list is a little bit off.
So it's an example.
Compiled, yeah. So
those are example cities. It's not meant to be.
Well, it was meant to be exhaustive, but maybe Pacific Grove missing. Sand City.
There's 5 cities.
And they
there.
Are. They're right. They are. They are actually identified, and I left them off the list. Mistake on my part.
Okay, no problem. Thank you.
Yeah. The purpose, actually, of these 2 slides, of course, was to just illustrate that there is a broad scope of this effort. And the post-construction requirements that we develop are affecting virtually everybody in the region who's developing or has some sort of local authority and control over development. And I apologize for that oversight. So, along with this enrollment strategy, we included clear expectations of what these entities, what these municipalities should include in their stormwater management plans. And first and foremost, we asked them to provide for the protection of watershed processes like groundwater recharge, infiltration, surface water runoff. And we asked them to develop hydromodification controls. Hydromodification just being the alteration to the patterns and processes of runoff and sediment from a watershed into its receiving water that in turn result in other changes to the physical, chemical, and biological attributes of the receiving waters. So we asked them to specifically address hydromodification and to do so in a certain amount of time, and if they weren't able to do that, they would be required to use a set of criteria that we included in our letter of expectation on February 15th of 2008. So we're looking at 4 years ago this initial exercise was initiated. At the same time, the Water Board approved funding for a low-impact development initiative in the Central Coast region. And that initiative was intended and designed to provide for low-impact development assistance throughout our region, working mostly with cities but also with other entities and private entities as well. The work that the LID initiative has done helping municipal LID programs has been really critical to this effort. And it's included things like raising the awareness and understanding of the LID principles of LID, supporting them with tools, technical assistance, memos, technical guidance, and actually offering assistance with implementation of some of their projects. The Water Board was fortunate to be able to bring in one of the nation's leading experts in low-impact development, Dr. Darla Inglis, to lead the low-impact development initiative. And her work with the cities in developing and implementing low-impact development really informed the Water Board's approach to implementing post-construction requirements. We recognized that the cities were having considerable difficulty in developing even an approach to developing hydromodification control criteria. And Darla Inglis's work also confirmed this. And it was a letter that Dr. Inglis presented to us in April of 2009 that really initiated the development of a joint effort. And in that letter, the Low Impact Development Initiative suggested that we allow municipalities an opportunity to participate in a regional collaborative effort. And we were very supportive of that notion as well. So some of the benefits that would come from a joint effort would include working with others on the same time schedule and being able to pool resources. It would be a state of the science approach. We would bring in leading experts from around the country or from the area that would be able to inform us in our choice of developing these requirements. It would actually, most importantly, allow us to address the unique, tremendously variable conditions of the Central Coast and avoid using a one-size-fits-all approach to stormwater management, which is often the case in other permits. And it would definitely correspond closer to the goal that the Water Board has of healthy watersheds by expanding to some extent what we're talking about when we say hydromodification to include some of these other functions of watersheds that are affected by stormwater. And then most importantly, I think, is that we offered to bring money to the table and fund this effort. And we did this by asking the State Water Board for $600,000 from the cleanup and abatement account. And the State Water Board accepted this proposal, embraced it in effect, and was very interested in seeing what we could do. So we've moved forward with funding, and we were able to secure 100% participation from all of those regional entities that you saw on those slides in this effort. Now, just kind of step back and kind of start with the end of this process and say, what are we trying to do? Where are we trying to go? We're essentially just trying to get to that place where an applicant can come into a planning department or a city building department present a plan to a plan checker, and among the many things that plan checker is reviewing, they'll be considering the stormwater requirements for the project. And they'll be able to, using the data from the joint effort, they'll be able to locate that project within a particular zone of type of management strategy that we've identified. So if they're in Zone A, the project's located in Zone A, they'll then be routed to a set of requirements that are appropriate to the conditions in Zone A. And those would, in theory, be different than the conditions in Zone B. So this is providing that more refined and landscape-appropriate approach to implementing post-construction requirements. And with this end in mind, we were able to really arrive at the technical objectives for the project, which were to identify key watershed processes across the region, delineate those watershed processes into management zones. I think you're familiar with Sunset Gardens or Sunset Magazine's garden climate zones. This is a very similar approach to that. We're trying to delineate areas where similar conditions exist. We needed to then associate management strategies with those zones and ultimately arrive at the numeric criteria that would be required for a site located in one of those zones. Now, I'm going to go through very briefly some of these steps, but I want you to bear in mind that what I'm describing represents almost 2 years of very intensive technical work that was completed by very highly qualified scientists and technical people, and then reviewed by stakeholder committees that we've assembled to review the work. And I will first...
Are you going to give us some examples of a watershed process?
Yes. I will first address watershed processes and their spatial distributions across the Central Coast. And a good way to do this is to sort of throw up our favorite slide of a watershed anatomy and kind of describe some of these processes, but very briefly. The processes, of course, that we're talking about, let me see, the laser is here, include the infiltration and percolation of water as the rain comes out of the sky. It infiltrates into the water, into the watershed landscape. And it's only once you achieve some sort of saturation that you start to see overland flow of water, which then flows through channels into receiving water. And this surface runoff brings with it the delivery of sediment. It delivers organic matter. And those provide the physical and biological substance of habitat and organic life and biological aquatic life. What's not pictured here, though, is this what we could call the chemical and biological transformations that occur in the subsurface of a watershed. And that's the suite of processes that alter the chemical composition of water as it passes through the soil column into the receiving water. So the other process, of course, is that you get evapotranspiration from all of the surfaces of the watershed, with the vegetation providing a lot of water back into the atmosphere. So what do these processes look like in our region? Well, the dominant watershed process really throughout the region is groundwater infiltration. And infiltration supports base flow and interflow into wetlands and surface waters, as well as deep infiltration to groundwater. This is a picture on the Carrizo Plain, and you can see that between the foreground and the background, up to where the slope begins, there's no channels, no receiving waters of any sort. Water is actually infiltrating into the ground there. And it turns out that throughout our region, on most uncompacted and vegetated soils, the infiltration capacities are from 1 to several inches per hour, which means that the rainfall intensity of even the largest storms, some of the largest storms, can actually be accommodated. The second, second picture I wanted to show you was another expression of this infiltration and subsurface flow which occurs throughout our region, as well as the process of sediment creep that this picture illustrates. But again, you don't see a lot of channel formation even from that slope down to this creek that cuts across here. you're still getting subsurface flow of water before it initiates overland flow and creates channels. And then finally, when you get into steeper terrain and maybe some less stable geologic environments, you do begin to see these overland flow processes, and you see the erosion processes that occur with them, like rilling and gullying. So we recognize that these processes change as we develop the landscape. And our objectives for the post-construction requirements are really to allow for the development of the landscape while limiting the change or the conversion of these processes that occurs. So urbanization alters watershed processes, which in turn affects watershed health and beneficial uses. And some of those changes, of course, are the decrease in groundwater recharge. Again, the dominant change imposed by urbanization is the replacement of the process of infiltration with the process of overland flow. When you lose infiltration, you lose groundwater recharge, and you lose base flow to streams. Of course, urban landscapes generate pollutants. But adding to the challenge there is that urbanization also converts subsurface flow of water to overland flow, and eliminating many of those chemical and biological transformations that would otherwise be available to attenuate or mitigate or bioremediate the pollutants that are flowing across the landscape. And of course, we know that urbanization reduces riparian habitat just physically by removing it in many cases. So, much like these Sunset Magazine garden climate zones, the Central Coast can be divided into zones for managing stormwater. And we're calling these watershed management zones. The watershed management zones are based on three attributes of the physical landscape: the geological, the slope, and the receiving water type. This illustrates one of the interim products of our work, which is a map of 15 distinct landscape, physical landscape zones in our region reflecting slope and geologic condition. This is a map that reflects an assessment of the receiving water type throughout our region. You can see that most of our region, or maybe you can't because it's kind of far away, but most of our region, a project, individual project, will be in an area that drains to a stream before it drains into any other water body like a lake or the ocean. So many areas of our region are going to be confronted with needing to protect streams as receiving waters. But there will be examples where the project site first drains to a lake or to a wetland, or in some cases to a large river, which might be less susceptible to changes in a hydrologic regime, or they might flow directly to the ocean. So these combination of watershed receiving water types and physical landscape zones can be combined into our map of watershed management zones. And throughout the region, we've identified 10 distinct watershed management zones, which are a combination of receiving water type and physical landscape type. Just to give you an example of how this plays out, in a city like Santa Barbara, there might be two or three zones that the city will be expected to manage for in approving and reviewing development projects. In the city of Santa Maria, that's only two zones. There are actually some cities in our region that are solely within a single management zone. And then finally, up in Watsonville, we've got an example as well of there being two watershed management zones. So the next aspect of the technical objectives for the joint effort was to identify the management strategies that would be used within each of these different zones. We want strategies that, again, allow for the development to occur while avoiding the disruption of the key watershed processes in those zones. The strategies identified by the joint effort include things like flow control, treating water, very, very, very much a part of what's currently being done to manage stormwater. But we also have recognized the need to preserve the delivery of sediment and organic material preserve land and natural features, and maintain soil and vegetation so we don't lose some of those chemical and biological transformations that the watershed is capable of providing. So what we want to do is align these strategies with the processes. So, for example, flow control clearly is a strategy you use to manage the natural watershed process of overland flow. It also supports the management of infiltration, groundwater recharge. You can see in the maintenance of soil and vegetation will, of course, support the processes of chemical and biological transformation, as well as evapotranspiration, and the list kind of goes on. Our objective here is to align strategies to the processes we've identified occur within each of these zones.
Dominic, if I could just add a comment. This is just music to my ears. I mean, these are what I understand in a kind of natural economic analysis would be called ecosystem services. We pay a lot of money for infrastructure to help protect the water supply system, clean it up, and so forth. But by allowing the ecosystem itself to function, we are actually achieving those things without the built infrastructure it requires. So if ecosystem services is something you can integrate into your discussion as you continue to evolve and present this, I think that's another thing we can pull in to say this is a framework that's already been analyzed and understood the benefits of why this is so important.
Thank you. I think you're right that we are really creating a good framework for moving forward. The details are always going to be challenging, but having this framework in place is going to be very helpful as we move on.
Yeah. Dominic, can I ask you a question? In the middle of the page, it says under strategy, preserve delivery of sediment and organic matter, and then the other side, delivery of sediment. So I have a little confusion in my mind because normally under development, we're trying to reduce the delivery mm-hmm. of sediments and runoff particulates into our streams, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I understand that natural sediments are a desirable feature of a riparian zone. So my question is, can you give me an example of an action that would be taken in a stormwater management design that would preserve delivery of sediment but also reduce the sediment, the particulates that we don't want going into the receiving waters?
Yeah. The typical impact of urbanization is to increase the fine sediment load into the receiving waters. And this is largely through construction activities, but it can continue as time goes on with different sources of fine sediment that are no longer captured and sequestered on the landscape. So one of the key things you can do is introduce buffers around water bodies. And these buffers not only are the source of some of the sediment and organic material, but they also provide a filter for the material that's coming from higher up slope in the watershed before it reaches the receiving water. A lot of good sediment is going to come from natural levels of bank erosion. It's going to include coarse particles, larger particles. And so a certain amount of balance in the flow regime of a stream will maintain the sediment balance as well. And there's a lot that goes into trying to do that. It's very difficult to do. There aren't that many opportunities to control it on a site level. It really speaks to some of the more programmatic approaches like broad-scale riparian protection, and in some cases even delivering sediment, coarse sediment, in places that are really being robbed of sediment. Sure.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question? When you develop the strategies for the watershed processes, are you basing this on a 100-year flood? Because obviously there are significant variance between drought years. I mean, case in point, this year we're at 42% of annual. Last year we were at 160%. So you have great variation. So, you know, you have all these various strategies, some of which may work under a normal year, some of which may actually fail during flood years.
You're right. The size of an event will change the different process. But what we're trying to do is look at these processes in a longer term and identify those that are dominant in any particular location over time. We're not trying to get it down to the particular event. That will come later in this process. When we're trying to design facilities to address that process, we will take into account the rainfall, the size of the events that typically occur there, the volume of rain that actually hits that site, and its fate. But we aren't on an individual basis yet in the process looking at strategies out down to the event level. What you'll find is the event level related and precipitation event sizes are going to be part of developing stormwater control measures, which actually leads me to the next slide, which is something you probably are more familiar with, is our stormwater control measures that really allow you to achieve some of these strategies. And I thought I would start with the example of a design phase. It's the best opportunity you have to integrate some of these stormwater control measures into a plan. I apologize for the size of this image, but you'll see that this plan has included bioretention swales. It's included pervious pavement over here. That's the purple in the parking lot. The curb cuts are allowing rainfall that runs into the parking lot to enter rain gardens and biological treatment facilities in here. But even more importantly, an attribute of this design is that they've minimized the street width. So they've reduced the overall imperviousness to begin with, and then they've further reduced it by indicating there's no sidewalks in this particular design. But I just want to point out that the design phase is a critical point at which you start to integrate the stormwater control measures that lead you to attainment of the strategy. Another example you might be more familiar with or might have seen around is our street bulb outs, and these are really good examples of a measure that can treat runoff from a city street. It allows the water to enter a little curb cut here, enter this biological treatment system, and in effect, before it runs back out into the street. And those can actually be added on after the fact, and they're very expensive in some cases for retrofits, but they can be done.
Can you say then what that feature is called again, that design feature?
I called it a bulb out.
Bulb, like B-U-L-B?
B-U-L-B, yeah, okay. A bulb out. But that's just kind of the vernacular of urban planners, I think. What it really is a biological treatment system of some sort. And I don't want to try to apply a more technical word because it's probably called many things. But this is an example of a bioswale that we've had kind of in our bag of photos for years, but it's a bioswale developed at the UC Santa Barbara campus. And then finally, just an example of pervious pavement that's being used at Cal Poly to achieve infiltration on what would otherwise be an impermeable surface. So the last aspect of the objectives that we're trying to move toward are assigning these numeric criteria. And why is this so important? Well, you can tell people to go and implement a management strategy like low-impact development, or you can tell them to even go out and implement specific stormwater control measures like bioswales or pervious pavement. And if they don't have something associated with it that tells them what target to achieve, they're really never going to get us to what we want to get to, which is a performance-based approach to managing stormwater. It's very difficult to describe or define compliance as a regulator in a system which lacks these numeric requirements. And it's hard for designers of those facilities to know what exactly they're trying to accomplish. So this is a critical aspect of what we're doing, is to ultimately end up with these numeric criteria. I wanted to just assure you that the joint effort is not developing a set of criteria that no one has ever seen before. Our approach has been to evaluate the existing criteria that's being used throughout the country, mostly in California and the Pacific Northwest, to examine what are the appropriate strategies that the appropriate criteria that really are associated with our strategies and with our management zones as we've identified them. So our process is going to be coming to a head here shortly when we lay out the full universe of options and start to move toward and identify those that are most appropriate to our region and our region's subcategories of watershed management zones. Now, a post-construction stormwater management set of requirements includes these things I've mentioned, watershed zones, management strategies, numeric criteria. But it includes a couple of other things as well. The first is setting up the triggers that bring a project under these regulations. Essentially, it's a tool that you use to route a project when it comes to the planner into one of the categories that then determines which of the requirements apply. We call these applicability thresholds. They're a key part of developing stormwater requirements. The other is providing a means for achieving compliance with those requirements off-site when those requirements, because of a variety of circumstances, are either impossible or undesirable to achieve on-site. Call that alternative compliance. In the case of all applicability thresholds, there are several components that we have to address and include. One, of course, is the exemptions, things that you just aren't going to apply these requirements to no matter what. So, for example, re-roofing a house seems like an inappropriate thing. What you're trying to do with exemptions and with the thresholds themselves is find that right balance of having the administrative burden of implementing these requirements in balance with what you attain and what you achieve in terms of water quality protection. So if we bring in the entire universe, we find that our municipalities just simply can't administer a program like that. Excuse me. So there will be exemptions identified. Another thing you have to do, of course, is identify the parameter that you're going to use to trigger the requirement. In most cases around the country, we use the parameter of new or replaced impervious surface. And we will be examining that component and describing its appropriateness in this particular case. The third is the type of requirement that you might assign at different levels. So if small projects are subject to one set of requirements, there might be another set of requirements that kicks in for the bigger requirements, for the bigger projects. So that type of requirement at different thresholds is a key part.
Dominic, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You mentioned that roofs would be a exemption.
Yeah.
And I understand why. My question is, can we use roofs and as an example and other things like roofs that are exempted for good reason from the requirements but encourage ideas relative to roofs as incentives that might help balance out some exceedance of a trigger somewhere else? Because there's a lot of things you can do with roofs, and there's probably a lot of things you can do with other exemption components.
Yes. And I can address that in the context of explaining to you how that joint effort is approaching the development of applicability thresholds. The Low Impact Development Initiative Project Director, Darla Inglis, has convened a focus group of municipalities and stormwater staff to go through each of these components. And among those components, these exemptions are being, we're reviewing all of these exemptions and considering all of these components. But one of the things discussed in our focus group is that exact question. Is there another phase or a level of implementation that's appropriate for projects that are smaller or may represent a great opportunity, but maybe harder to achieve a broad blanket implementation? So we are looking at a set of what might be considered non-quantitative measures that can be triggered by smaller projects or by projects that would otherwise not really trigger a requirement of numeric robust nature.
Okay, I think maybe I wasn't clear enough.
Sorry.
If, for example, a large project or a small project incorporates living roofs, mm-hmm. might that give them a numerical credit mm-hmm. that could be balanced against something that they don't want to do that we want them to do
yeah.
that dings them numerically?
We definitely envision that kind of thing. We probably won't identify it as part of applicability thresholds, but in the design of actual facilities, once you have your requirement, you're trying to achieve that requirement, there will be sizing tools and different tools that are available to allow a project applicant to say, well, look, I'm converting part of my impervious surface, my roof, to a permeable passive system, in effect, for maintaining and managing stormwater. and I will subtract that from the amount of land that I actually have to put through this other device, which I'm really trying to, you know, fit into my project. So that's a pretty typical outcome in areas where low-impact development and hydromodification controls have been in place for a while.
So this process will allow for that sort of consideration?
I fully expect it to. But again, we're not going to specify that detail at this phase in the applicability thresholds. That'll come in the project design guidance. Okay? So, where was I? This last piece is alternative compliance. Again, we're looking for a way to address the circumstances that might actually challenge implementation on site. And so I just put a definition up here that for the purposes of the joint effort, alternative compliance is viewed as an approach undertaken by a municipality to provide an off-site alternative for projects that would not be able to achieve the requirements. In other words, the city is trying to do a uniform application of their parcel scale requirements, no ifs, ands, or buts. We know that's that's doomed sort of for failure. There has to be some off ramps. So there's certain circumstances, again, which you might try to do this. Technical obstacles like high groundwater are a good example, where you just simply can't achieve the treatment requirement or the hydromodification infiltration requirement. And so there needs to be a mechanism that describes how you get out of that and where you can do that off-site instead. Secondly, redevelopment projects, these are areas downtown. If they try to develop or meet the requirements, they find that there's a lot of constraints on development. And we also recognize that there might be less benefit from actually imposing those requirements in a context where a significant amount of degradation has already occurred and that our option or our possibility for restoration is limited or only partially available. And then finally, you might look for opportunities where a city or some other entity has actually completed a more refined watershed scale analysis that defines, that identifies another location where mitigation is better for protecting watershed processes. We want to provide for all of these types of situation, but the Water Board needs to clearly define the situations in which alternative compliance is appropriate based on water quality considerations. That is our mandate, and that's what we have to ultimately consider these against. Just a couple more slides here. I know you're just dying to get back to that other item, that other unnamed item. And that is the stakeholder involvement. On table one of your package in item 17, you'll see just a long list of all of the milestones that we've completed for the development of the joint effort. And you'll note that there's many, many circumstances in which public and stakeholder involvement was provided. But I want to make a special mention of the joint effort review team, which is an advisory committee that we put together. It's described in the staff report as well. But these folks have come from municipalities, some from the consulting community and the resource management community. They've come together to really commit themselves to reviewing copious technical documents. They deserve a lot of credit, and I hope to someday recognize them personally. And the second is the applicability thresholds focus group. It's a smaller group, but again, it represents an extreme amount of commitment from our stakeholders to a process that they all have a stake in, but making the time and the commitment to actually support solutions is often challenging. I really appreciate their support. And then finally, we have had a lot of stakeholder workshops. We started those workshops back in September of 2009, and I just want you to know we're continuing with that. We just held our final set of workshops. We have a kind of a two-step process. We held two of those workshops at the end of February, and we're holding another two in April. And just to kind of inform you that there's a schedule, just to bring to your awareness, this is coming up kind of on you quickly, but you have about 4 months, or we all have about 4 months to complete these final stages. I want you to note that on March 21st, next week, we'll actually be presenting the package of post-construction requirements to that joint effort review team, that group that we've assembled to help us vet and review this content. then we'll meet to discuss those on the 28th of March, and then about a little less than a month later, we'll ask them to give their final comments on that. And then the Water Board will bring all that together and try to recompile it and present it to the larger group of stakeholders, public and all stakeholders, and then hold two workshops on April 24th and 25th. We're doing that to accommodate or to reduce the travel burden for the municipalities. So we'll hold one in Watsonville and one in Santa Maria, and we'll roll out these and discuss these proposed requirements. We'll accept comments for that for those as late as May 18th. And in order to prepare a final recommendation to you in July. Thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
And Dominic, if you could refresh my memory, do we have phase two permits issued for every phase two entity in the region?
All of our traditional phase twos are now enrolled.
Okay, and so this component, the LID hydro mod component, is just kind of waiting for this finalization process, and then we'll be activated.
In fact, the enrollment of those entities included a commitment on their part to participate, or not the enrollment, but their stormwater management plans include a commitment to implement joint effort criteria when they're developed.
Great.
So the permit is in effect already approved for that.
Okay, good. Don't take them away from us, Fran. This staff. Huh? We have to share, I know, but we got to get. I know.
I know what
that
means
sometimes.
That
it goes one way.
Well, I think, yeah.
Okay, Mr. Johnston and then Mr. Delgado.
Yes, I recall that our Salinas stormwater permit, which is our only phase one permit.
Again, Mike is on the mic.
It is. Is
that better?
No.
Is that better?
No, not yet.
I recall that our
okay, how's that?
That's good.
I recall that our Salinas stormwater permit, which is our only phase one permit, and which is coming back to us in June or in July? May?
May.
It's coming back in May?
May.
Okay, that was my question, because I know it incorporated this, and I didn't want to see them coming at the same time. That would have been confusing. All right. Okay. That's all I wanted to know.
All right.
Quick question. Could the watershed management zone designations, the way you perceive it coming along, have such different requirements that development projects might be discouraged in one zone versus another? You know, Zone A has lots of requirements. Zone B doesn't. So, are they expected to be that different that developers might want to go to a different zone because of the stormwater requirements?
That's an interesting question. It's a hypothetical that a lot of folks have presented, and some people come down on the conclusion that, yes, applying these requirements here is going to drive the development over there. Others have responded that there's really no clear evidence that that kind of thing occurs, and I think what they tend to bring up is that there are so many factors that determine where development occurs that I think I'm getting feedback, John, that the mere implementation or a requirement of stormwater requirements is not going to be the thing that pushes development from place to place. But that said, this does provide a framework for an urban entity or a city or a county to actually consider, well, you know, these watershed management zones seem to be more resilient or have less impact when we disturb them through urbanization. And so why don't we try to move our development over there? So it has different implications, but with regards to the actual choice the developer makes and where they develop, so far there's really no clear evidence that someone is going to change their location. I hear from city staff that this happens all the time, that the Taco Bell decided to move over here or to walk away because of the requirements being placed on it. I don't know if those were the stormwater requirements or the accumulation of requirements that come down on a project in any city these days. But we don't have a real strong basis for concluding that will happen at this point. And we've got sort of evidence on both sides.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm sure you know both Mr. Young and I live in a fantasy land. We have a city down there that supports this wholeheartedly, and an enterprise fund that funds about $2.5 million a year that that looks for projects like this. There's very little I heard that I'm not enthralled about, other than the fact that something so logical develops into such a bureaucracy, that it takes this from the top down rather than the bottom up to move in this direction. And I'm certain you've already gone this direction, but one of my experiences is that the process works really well when you actually target the design professionals that work with redevelopment or infill, such as the local AIA branch or the environmental planning firms, or you actually figure out who the planning commissioner members are or the architectural board review members are, and you do specific outreach to them. When those people bring the projects in at the counter stage that they've already talked to their clients about and convinced their clients that they're a step in the right direction, it just seems a lot easier as you start to work your way up the chain and bump into that sometimes culture issue with public works departments. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that's a component. I love the idea of almost a transfer of development rights, or in this case a transfer of responsibilities to another site. Your example of downtown core areas, like a downtown shopping area, downtown Santa Barbara, would be perfect, where it's already built out. It's the building envelopes are property line to property line, and if somebody's going to come in there and do a project, they really have no opportunity to make gains on their stormwater runoff. And the ability to transfer those responsibilities somewhere else, especially to a public benefit place, a park or a school, should be an integral part of that program. So great presentation. Looking forward to hearing more.